Thank you for joining us again. We're here yet again. It's another week. That's the way this show works here at the Overlap Podcast. We hit you up every week with a new episode, some new content, something new to think about, something new to do, something new to be a part of. I am Joshua. I'm one of your hosts here. We have our co-host here, Will. Will, say hello.
Hello, Joshua. We are nothing if not consistent.
Hey, I like consistency.
Indeed.
So today's podcast is actually a topic of my choosing. I thought it would be interesting to kind of pick apart an exegesis, if you will, of a very particular topic, much like we did the previous healthcare topic. But before we get started in what is literally contains the word doomsday, I wanted to just give a little bit of lighthearted something so that you don't absolutely feel depressed either at the beginning or the end of this episode. So I discovered this fantastic feature on YouTube. You can adjust the speed. Now, for people like me who just need to consume information quickly, I've completely given up on even watching YouTube when I'm trying to learn something. I send that YouTube video to Gemini and I'm like, give me a transcription of this and then cut it down to only the meaty parts, right? Like you could save time by doing that with AI. But for the enjoyment of content, I like watching foodie videos. I like watching, you know, tours of different cities and things like that. And also being a banjo player and an avid news watcher, I discovered this fun playback speed setting. If you go into the settings, you can do it through your mobile app. You can do it through the regular app. If you take any video of Dr. Phil or Banjo Ben Clark, I said I wouldn't get a pick on Banjo Ben Clark, but I'm going to pick on him just a little bit. Just go to YouTube.
On his own.
Right, exactly. Picking the banjo. So go to YouTube, search for Dr. Phil or Banjo Ben Clark or Vince Gill for that matter. I mean, anybody with like, a twang in their thing. Put the playback speed to anywhere between 0.5 and 0.75 and they sound absolutely hammered drunk.
Dr. Phil is like, I'm not sure anybody else has a show that is like mine.
And so if you want a little bit of joy in your life, and it works with so many people, it works with so many videos, just listen to it between 0.5 and 0.75. And whoever that person is sounds absolutely hammered. I'm relatively sure it would work for, you know, presidential figures and things like that. If you just need a little bit of lighthearted punching up in your life. Or if you need punching down, you know, pick Banjo Ben Clark. He has a wonderful store there in Exeter, Missouri.
I've been told actually that I talk a little too fast. So if you need it just on normal for me, maybe bump it down to 0.75 and I'll sound normal.
Who says that you talk too fast?
Well, I almost lost a motion for summary judgment in a courtroom once where the judge said I was talking too fast. So
hey, we just got to get the content in. You and me are the same in that aspect. It's like, look, it's about the content. Did you receive it? Like,
exactly.
Maybe you could play back the recording so that you can hear what I said because it was all in there. That's whether right. or not you caught it, that's not on me.
Had a lot to say and a little time to say it.
Exactly. So now that we have our little bit of lighthearted, let's talk about a really fun topic that everyone loves to discuss.
I can't wait. What is it? Christmas? Candy?
Almost Christmas. Oh, it's so close to Christmas. The doomsday clock.
Oh, that old chestnut.
So you might have or you might not have heard of the doomsday clock, but it's mentioned quite often in pop references. It's mentioned in the news. Anytime something major happens that could lead to the superficial destruction of our entire planet and all of humanity, it gets brought up, right? And especially gets brought up when the doomsday clock is adjusted. So I thought it would be interesting if we kind of dived deep on the origins, the history, what the doomsday clock is, and specific incidents throughout its history that the clock has been moved up to be closer to midnight. And we'll talk more about why that is. Will, would you like to go on a journey with me?
I would love to. Let's discuss the end. Let's perch on the precipice of the end of human civilization and comment on as we're wont to do.
Yes, let's walk hand in hand and talk about our joy. I do want to give a very special thanks to my friend Adam. He knows who he is, who left this bottle of Ménage à Trois Sweet Collection Dolce Sweet Red Blend at my house around New Year's. I just got to realizing that there was half a bottle left and I'm enjoying it. So thanks, Adam. We appreciate you.
You're a good man, Adam.
All right, so the doomsday clock. What is it? Well, it's a stark and universally recognized emblem of humanity's precarious position in the face of self-inflicted global catastrophes. So it's ultimately a visual metaphor, symbolic clock that gauges the proximity of our world to utter annihilation.
Annihilation.
It's kind of a recognition of humanity's ability to destroy itself, right? It's like, hey, we've arrived on the world scene. We're a global species now. Oh, and by the way, we figured out how to blow ourselves up. So let's see if we can track how close we are to doing that.
Yes, Will is doing a little bit of foreshadowing about the cause and the purposes, why this exists. Originally, I do want to say that Will's absolutely right. So this was initially focusing on the threat of nuclear war, right? So it was broadening its scope now, of course, to things outside of that, talking about dangerous technologies and global challenges and things like this. But ultimately, this clock was created with the purpose of measuring how close we were to total nuclear annihilation.
Using a rigorously determined metric, I'm sure.
Of course. But wait, there's more. So what we want to talk about really is we kind of want to talk about the history of the Doomsday Clock. We want to talk about where it came from. We want to talk about the motivations that led to its creation. Basically, it's going to trace, or we're going to trace the instances of when the clock's hand has inched forward, providing an account of the specific events and factors that precipitate the adjustments. So ultimately, we're just going to examine the clock's enduring purpose and the evolution of its message for not only you and me, but for the world as a whole, outside of the United States as well. So yes, the genesis of the clock, like I was discussing, is basically kind of combined with the aftermath of World War II inside of the dawn of the atomic age. Obviously, we had unprecedented development and deployment of nuclear weapons through the Manhattan Project. If you have not read about or listened to or heard about the Manhattan Project, it's a really cool read. You know, if you like science, if you like data, if you're not a huge science reader, I would recommend checking out. There's a television show called The Manhattan Project. There's also several movies that have been made specifically about The Manhattan Project. Check those out on Netflix. Check those documentaries out on YouTube if that's your thing. Read where you can. So the scientists who actually contributed to the project were immediately kind of confronted with the moral and societal implications of their creation. I would think that they kind of knew what those would be in the process of creating it. But realistically, if you don't think you can do something, but you're still inching toward it, you don't actually have to face the music of the consequences of it until it's actually completed, right?
Right. I think, wasn't it during the test firing? And I could be jumbling a bunch of things together, but if I recall, Oppenheimer was one of the scientists on that team, right? And I think it was after observing the first test firing of the nuclear weapons, he was kind of like, he felt a move to quote, was Ozymandias, "I'm become death, destroyer of worlds," or something like that.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So that was kind of his realization. It's like, oh, this is not good. This is this is pretty big. That was a big bomb, big explosion.
And unfortunately, there was not a whole lot of time between that test and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So obviously we nuked parts of Japan. And so that created an immediate sense of urgency and responsibility among specifically scientists, specifically the people who were working on the Manhattan Project, and forced them to kind of grapple with the consequences of the science that they had been working on for 4 years. So in 1945, you have this sort of backdrop of nuclear tension, collective of scientists known as the Chicago Atomic Scientists, who had been absolutely pivotal to the Manhattan Project at the University of Chicago, created the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. There were people, you know, one that Will mentioned, Oppenheimer, Einstein, Eugene Rabinovich, that were founders and early sponsors of the initiative. But their primary objective was to kind of inform the public, but also lawmakers, about the dangers inherent nuclear technology, and also to advocate for the international control measures to prevent the use of it. They felt a profound obligation to share their unique understanding of these weapons, their potential goal for global devastation. So Einstein even said, right, I don't know with which World War II will be fought, but World War III will be fought with sticks and stones.
Meaning we'll blow ourselves back into the Stone Age, essentially.
Exactly. Oh, 1947, the creation of the Doomsday Clock stemmed directly from the concerns of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and their deep-seated passion for not wanting to see the world blown into nuclear hell.
And how did they arrive at the decision to use a clock to illustrate that point?
We'll get there.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was meant to be a segue, but it's a little early. Sorry, folks.
Yes, we're building up. We're covering the boring part, right? Ultimately, which is the history. It's kind of thinking about where we are. So, August 1945, right? The scientists were very aware of the threat that nuclear weapons posed to humanity. The firsthand experience of these tests, of the actual science behind it, fueled a sense of urgency to prevent it from ever being used. So, the initial editor of that scientific bulletin said that he wanted to, quote, frighten men into rationality regarding the perils of nuclear war.
I think we'll see some parallels here to the current AI arms race, right? I mean, we can kind of see how that's playing out in real time with the more recent technologies that could be developed and deployed to destroy human civilization, right?
Yes. And I do want you to, not just you, Will, but you, listener, to also think about other emerging technologies that might fit into this narrative. Now, obviously, the Doomsday Clock has incorporated things outside of just nuclear, but it was the biggest scientific advancement of their time. And in a lot of ways, it reminds me of a quote that actually Will's dad told me. And what he said was, if you can't love them into heaven, then you scare them out of hell. And I feel like these scientists, this board of scientists, was essentially, that's exactly what they were doing. They're like, well, we can't love our society into peace because we've created these weapons, but if we explain to them exactly the danger of these weapons, then we can scare them the hell out of using them.
Right. Since not everybody's going to show up at Woodstock in a few years, let's
exactly
go ahead and give them the Judgment House version of that.
Right. Yes. So, To visually represent the urgency, they commissioned an artist named Martel Langsdorff, the wife of a Manhattan Project research associate, to design the cover for their magazine's inaugural issue in June of 1947. Langsdorff conceived the image of a clock as a potent symbol of impending danger and a countdown to potential disaster. Remember, they're counting down to a nuclear explosions in these tests, right? So a clock would be a visual representation of that countdown. The first iteration of the clock's hands was 7 minutes to midnight. According to the original artist, was an aesthetic choice because it looked good to her eye. Now, over the years, the design's been updated. In 2007, a graphic designer, Michael Beirut, was asked to kind of make it feel a little more modern and impactful. But it was a direct and profound response from the scientific community, particularly to people who had witnessed the dawn of the nuclear age. They had a keen understanding of the destructive force that they had unleashed, and they wanted to take a step that nobody had really taken before. Just basically owning the fact that there was a potential for global annihilation. I think you fact check me if you'd like to, but I think it would take 18 nuclear weapons detonated at one time to set the Earth off of its axis, and we would essentially just start revolving into space. And I don't know how many nuclear weapons the U.S. has.
It's more than 18.
I guarantee it's more than 18. It is, as of 2025, we have 5,177 nuclear warheads, which includes deployed, reserved, and retired, awaiting dismantlement.
Is that enough to blast us anywhere near 16 Psyche?
What? Yes, but I can't guarantee the quality of our ability to achieve anything once we get there.
It's like, reminds me
either of, as a society, as a species, or as a planet.
Right. Reminds me of the old Marvin the Martian bit, you know, where he's planning to blow up the Earth. He's got his plutonium or whatever, you know, his nuclear element that he's going to use to blow the Earth apart. You know, I think that's probably what most of us wouldn't arrive intact if we blew ourselves anywhere.
Exactly.
Out of our current orbit.
You got to love that suspension of disbelief in those old animated cartoons.
Strange Earthling.
I actually always thought he was so eloquent. He was so eloquent and interesting. Yes. Anyway, sidebar. So the initial setting of the clock, right? 7 minutes before midnight, while it might seem just like a choice, right? It was the early recognition that we were in a new nuclear era, right? And that we were there. So that kind of gives, that's a summary of the history behind why the clock got started, what, why it exists, who did it, kind of who, what, when, where, and why, right? It's sort of that background understanding. So I want to talk for a minute about the advancements, the things that have happened, or the things that happened from 1947 till January, actually. January was the last time that the clock was updated. I'm not going to tell you what day. I don't know that it matters that much. It was in January. So I will say, and you'll probably see this, but it was very heavy-handed at the beginning. They were much more heavy-handed than they are today. But so it's been adjusted. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 times. The clock's only been adjusted 17 times since 1940. And it has gone forward and backwards. So it's not just like, you know, it's not a normal timer where they just keep counting down the seconds or anything like that. So it does kind of reflect the shifting tides of global security and new threats that are not necessarily nuclear. So here's, let's talk about some of these instances. Will, do you have any questions? Are you excited?
I'm excited to see what moves the clock backwards. That's what I'd like to get back to that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the first movement from 1947 was actually in 1949, wasn't very long after it. They moved it forward by 4 minutes, right? Like, and we're talking, ultimately, there is no, I don't know, benchmark at this point. It's the first time they've ever moved it. And I'm thinking 7 minutes, and they move it forward 4 minutes. Something bad must really be bad. You're not wrong. The Soviet Union tested its first atomic bomb, marking the first markings of the beginning of a nuclear arms race. So it was no longer, you know, it wasn't just the hare. The tortoise was also in the game.
We're at least, well, arguably twice as likely now to blow ourselves to oblivion as we were before. Or twice as many actors can blow us to oblivion as there were before.
Exactly. The next time wasn't till four years later. 1953, they moved it forward by a minute. So 2 minutes to midnight. Both the United States and the Soviet Union tested their first thermonuclear devices, specifically H-bombs, significantly escalating the destructive potential of nuclear arsenals.
It was around this time that kids started hiding underneath their desks during...
This was the first time that the United States created a plan in the event that we detected an incoming nuclear weapon. Just yes. So this was the beginning of the air raids.
It's kind of concerning that we waited that long to make a plan.
Well, I mean, we had a plan from World War One, right? Like, I mean, there was still the possibility of actual air raids. But what I think is funny is that people think that they're going to survive it somehow if they just tuck their head between their legs and kiss their butts goodbye.
Yeah. I mean, there's some argument about whether that was meant to be more of a psychological thing than any kind of real preparation. Because like you said, I mean, if the nuclear bomb goes off anywhere near you, it doesn't matter what you're under.
Yeah, it's all coming down. If the explosion doesn't get you, the fallout will.
Right.
Right, depending on the air and the way the air is moving and the jet streams. That was 1953. 1968 moved forward by 5 minutes. So in 1968, 7 minutes to midnight, moved forward by 5 minutes. The intensification of the Vietnam War, the Indo-Pakistani War, and the Six-Day War. France and China acquired and tested nuclear weapons for the first time in 1968.
So once again, doubled our number of nuclear capable countries, and things are not looking good.
Exactly. Okay, I see the problem. Time set change. Got it. In 1974, it moved forward again by 3 more minutes. Now, you're like, wait a minute, 1 minute, 5 minute, 8 minutes. The original clock was not actually 7 minutes to midnight. That is the update from 2007 and the representation thereof. So if you go to Doomsday Clock, I think it's .org. That is current time, timeline. Yes, 1947, 1949. We're in 1953, 54, 55. Here we are. Okay, so 1953, 1960, 63, 68. Sorry, guys. Looking that data up as we speak. So that's the intensification of the Vietnam War, the Indo-Pakistani War, the Six-Day War, where we doubled the number of people who own nuclear weapons. It was updated again in 1969 when all of the world's nations came together to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. The states with nuclear weapons vow to help the treaty's other signatories develop nuclear power if they promise not to produce weapons. So the nuclear weapon states also pledge to abolish their own arsenals when political conditions allow for it. Israel, India, and Pakistan refused to sign it, but the organization remained optimistic. The great powers have made the first step. I'm quoting them. The great powers have made the first step. They must proceed without delay to the next one. The dismantling gradually of their own oversized military established. So, yes, 1968. We're actually going to go back a little bit because the chart I was reading from missed the time where it actually moved moved backwards. So 1963 1960. The Cold War developed in the 1950s and saw a succession of close nuclear calls, such as the Suez Crisis in 1956 and the Lebanon Crisis in 1958. But in 1960, there was an impression that measures were being taken to sort of dampen the tensions and allay the threat of nuclear catastrophe. They actually moved it back 5 minutes in 1960 to 7 minutes to midnight. 3 years later, America and the Soviet Union signed a partial test ban treaty prohibiting all test detonations of nuclear weapons, except those conducted underground. So despite the nuclear missile crisis at Cuba, so the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Doomsday Clock assessment heralded the treaty as an encouraging event and knocked another 5 minutes off of the clock. So at this point, we're 12 minutes to midnight, right? So then 1968, we're back up to our current chart, where you have the Vietnam War, the acquisition of nuclear weapons by France and China, neither of which signed the partial test ban treaty, contributing to a ramping up global tension. 1969, with most countries in the world, except for India, Israel, and Pakistan, signing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, Rabinovich detected a significant steadying of nuclear instability, and the doomsday clock was adjusted accordingly, further out 3 minutes. So now we're 10 minutes to midnight. So it looks like there's starting to become this really positive situation from like the 1960 to 1969, 1972. The threat of nuclear devastation further diminished thanks to the U.S. and the Soviet Union signing two more treaties, including the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. And they moved the clock back again 2 minutes to 12 minutes to midnight. Then 1974 came back around. After 14 years of the doomsday clock moving in a positive direction, the organization reversed the positive trend in 1974. It said that the international nuclear arms race had gathered momentum and is now more than ever beyond control. So they moved it to 9 minutes until midnight. 2 years later, 1974, they moved it yet again by 3 minutes. Oh, sorry. Nope. That was the 1974. 1980 moved it to 7 minutes. So 2 minutes closer to midnight. The U.S. refused to ratify the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. The Soviet-Afghan War began, and the organization moved the clock 2 minutes closer to midnight, citing the irrationality of national and international actions. The next year, it was moved 3 minutes closer. As nuclear tensions ramped up considerably, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan prompted the U.S. boycott of the 1980 Olympics in Moscow, and America adopted a more hardline Cold War position following the election of Ronald Reagan. The Hollywood actor turned president argued that the only way to end the Cold War was to win it and dismissed arms reductions talks with the Soviet Union. We're 4 minutes to midnight at this point in 1981. 1984, the year I was born, we moved to 3 minutes, moved only by 1 minute. The Soviet-Afghan War intensifies. The U.S. continues to escalate the arms race, deploying missiles in Western Europe. Soviet Union and most of its allies boycotted the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. 1988, 4 years later, again, things seemed to start to ease. They moved to 6 minutes, so backwards 3 minutes, because U.S.-Soviet relations have started to improve. They signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. They banned all of the two nations' land-based ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and missile launchers within ranges of 500 to 1,000 kilometers. That is 310 to 620 in freedom units, and from 1,000 to 5,500 kilometers, and that's 620 to 3,420 freedom units for intermediate range. So they banned short, medium, and intermediate range missiles, ICBMs capable of reaching those things. So again, moved. 2 years later, moved it again 4 minutes to 10 minutes to midnight when the Berlin Wall came down, the collapse of the Iron Curtain, that signaling that the Cold War was pretty close to the end. And so they added that another 3 minutes. The next year, They moved it 7 minutes to midnight. The U.S. and the USSR both signed the first strategic arms reduction treaty called START 1. And that was the time at which the Soviet Union was dissolved. And that point in 1991 marked the furthest the clock has ever been from midnight, 1991. 17 minutes. 1995, we moved to 14 minutes. The clock edged 3 minutes closer to midnight as global military spending showed no sign of decreasing, and the eastward expansion of NATO threatened to cause Russia to get upset.
And at that point, 1995, we have more than 40,000 nuclear weapons worldwide.
Gross. Yeah. 1998, only 3 years later, they moved the clock back yet again 5 minutes. With news that India and Pakistan were both testing nuclear devices. Let's see. The organization actually noted a heightened sense of peril and moved the clock forward by 5 minutes. In 2002, the year that I graduated from high school, the clock moved 2 minutes forward again to 7 minutes to midnight after the U.S. vetoed a series of arms controls and announced its intent to withdraw from the anti-ballistic missile treaty due to the perceived threat of a nuclear terrorist attack. Terrorist attack. I was trying to pull George W. out of there.
Terrorist
attack.
The nuclear kind of terrorist.
Nuclear terrorist. In 2007, 5 years later, we moved back again, or moved forward again by 2 minutes due to the news of North Korea's nuclear test and Iran's nuclear ambitions. I don't know if we can say that truthfully any longer, but at the time, that was what was believed. Iran's nuclear ambitions, they highlighted the threat of climate change. It also moved the clock forward by 2 minutes. In 2010, 6 minutes to midnight, so moved back by a minute, the new START nuclear arms reduction treaty was ratified by the U.S. and Russia after further disarmament talks were planned. In 2009, the United Nations Climate Change Conference recognized that climate change is one of the greatest challenges to the present day and that actions should be taken to keep any temperature increases to below 2 degrees Celsius or centigrade. So this is the first point at which we really start to see them expand the clock's algorithm. And I use that term loosely. You'll understand why, to include more than just nuclear war, nuclear arms, nuclear bombs. So in 2012, it moved to 5 minutes, 1 minute closer, because of a lack of global political action to address climate change and decrease nuclear stockpiles. In 2015, it was moved up additional 2 minutes to 3 minutes to midnight. It edged forward another 2 minutes with the bulletin citing unchecked climate change, global nuclear modernizations, and outsized nuclear weapons arsenals. 2017, they moved forward 30 seconds to midnight when President Trump's public dismissal of climate change and comments about nuclear weapons prompted the bulletin to move the clock forward by a half a minute. In 2018, the next year, it was moved forward again another 30 seconds under Trump's administration. The U.S. withdrew from the Paris Accords and the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Information warfare and, quote, disruptive technologies such as synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and cyber warfare are cited as further threats to humanity. In 2020, 2 years later, 100 seconds to midnight, the end of Immediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, between the United States and Russia, and other mounting nuclear concerns were cited by the bulletin as the clock moved closer to midnight than ever before.
Also feels more serious when you start talking in seconds as opposed to minutes.
It does feel a little more poignant, right?
Yes.
In 2023, clock moved forward by 10 seconds to 90 seconds to midnight. After Russia invaded Ukraine, and the bulletin cited the increased risk of nuclear escalation, along with ongoing threats from climate change, biological risks, and disruptive technologies such as AI. And lastly, January 2025, it moved forward 1 second to 89 seconds to midnight due to continuing war in Ukraine and the Middle Eastern crisis, increased nuclear proliferation, climate change effects, biological threats, and advancing technologies, as well as leaders' failure to reverse course.
And there we stand. So, as Joshua mentioned, he was reading the official reasons for moving the clock, but there were a lot of things, and we'll talk about some of the positives and negatives of this. You might notice some overlap between obscure reference to our show meant there, but you might see some overlap between which direction and when the clock moves and which political party is in power. But also there are cultural things that happen around this. And between 1980 and 1984, you have a little movie called War Games coming out, wherein a young Matthew Broderick almost causes nuclear war by trying to fix his grades on the school computer and narrowly averts nuclear war by teaching the computer, the AI, interestingly named Joshua, if memory serves. No relation, but convinces Joshua to play TikTok.
There is a relation.
There's a relation.
Watch yourself.
I wasn't going to, overstep there, but we have Matthew Broderick teaching the computer to play tic-tac-toe, which is a solvable game wherein no one wins if you played properly, and that convinces the AI in control of our nuclear weapons not to proliferate and not to start a nuclear war or engage in a nuclear arms race. So just a little bit of cultural background surrounding the various moves of the clock. So,
yeah, I think, obviously we have it moving forward until 1974, where there was a 3-minute advance. And ultimately what you saw was a period of optimism, right? Like kind of at the end of the Cold War, the clock moved forward again to 14 minutes. And I mean, despite the collapse of the Soviet Union, global military spending remained at levels pretty comparable to Cold War, right? Like, I mean, lots of people were worried about, security and the proliferation of nuclear weapons and expertise from the former Soviet Republic scientists, right, being moved kind of throughout the former USSR. The eastward expansion of NATO has been really, under a keen eye by Russia, obviously most notably Putin, which is ultimately the reason for the invasion of Ukraine. Right. I mean, in 1998, you have your 5 minutes to 9 minutes. It was just there were lots of nuclear tests happening at that time. India, Pakistan, both really started expanding their nuclear arsenals. I mean,
not to mention the Y2K virus or both.
It's funny. That was never enough of a cause, right, in the organization as a whole. Now, remember, this organization specifically is comprised entirely of scientists. And I think that's an important note to take, right? Like, is that these are people who pride themselves on peer review and on research and on citing sources and on factually based data.
Are you disparaging
I'm afraid I am, Will, because I think that there's something to the fact that scientists were not concerned enough with Y2K to move the clock.
That's just because all these guys probably programmed in COBOL. They're like, we can fix it. No problem.
But that's the benefit, right? Like you have scientists and then by extension, engineers. Scientists think about it. Engineers do it. Sorry, that's my bias, who were confident in their ability to make that programming change to avoid any possible, bad things. So, especially in 2020, and I mean, 2020, I wonder what happened in that year, right? It reached its closest point to midnight in all of history at 100 seconds, right? Now, it was basically the convergence of like 16 crises that were all happening at the same time. We obviously have COVID, right? So pandemic outbreak. That's the biggest one that comes to mind when we think of 2020. Also, the failure of the United States president to react appropriately to a pandemic, but also China's response to a pandemic, which ultimately went kind of further into communist dictatorship. So not just to make fun of our president, but also Xi Jinping at the time. So in addition to that, actual statesmanship, like actual discussions between countries are starting to break down too, because you have the Intermediate Nuclear Range Forces, the INF Treaty, right? Escalating tensions between the U.S. and Iran, because Iran is still continuing their nuclear program. At the same time, you have nothing happening in climate change, right? Like we can joke about green energy all we want, but ultimately we understood, and I feel like anybody who is pro-green energy understands that like there has to be some years of less than efficient research and active like in-person work that needs to be done to get to a point where the efficiency increases to the point that it does better than fuels, non-renewable resources. Then there were threats rising from the cyber-enabled information warfare, right? And the decline in international cooperation. So China wasn't talking to the United States. The United States wasn't talking to South America. The United States wasn't talking to Canada. They weren't talking to Europe. Ultimately, they were all trying to handle this in their own way. Our president at the time, who's also our president at the current time, chose to obfuscate the realities of the situation from the American people, as opposed to other countries. You know, we have a lot of things that are really sort of cross-pollinating here. And actually, the Bulletin quoted themselves as saying that it was the most dangerous situation that humanity had ever faced, ever, until 2023.
Wait, right? Which said, 2020, hold my beer.
Exactly, exactly. And look, here's the difference, right? Like, we're starting to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic, but you have Russia, right, suspended its participation in the new START treaty, the START 2 treaty, if you're familiar with international politics, and also nuclear reactor sites being literally damaged or in some cases threatened to be damaged by Russia's forces in Ukraine, obviously contributed to, you know, a sense of peril and ongoing threats from climate change, biological risks, COVID-19, obviously, but also we're starting to even see then, even in 2023, we're starting to see variants of COVID-19, right? We're starting to see advanced progressions of COVID-19. Not to mention, you have your challenges posed by disinformation campaigns. Russia has been hard at work at that. China has been hard at work at that. North Korea has been hard at work at that. And disruptive technologies, right? We're starting ChatGPT, language learning models, which, regardless of how much we like AI, has a negative effect on climate change. I was reading the other day that, like, apparently when you ask a question to one of the language learning models, there's like 6 gallons of water that are lost. It's the equivalent of 6 gallons of water being wasted because of the cooling procedures, because of the natural resources, because of global warming that are actively happening as we pump hotter and hotter air from these giant data centers full of GPUs into the atmosphere.
Certainly going to have an effect in the short term. Like you said, I mean, that's part of the challenge of this is that there's a back and forth that happens, right? I mean,
yes.
You know, when you advance, so you get another nuclear reactor on the stage, that raises tensions, but it also, in a sense, creates an urgency within the leaders to put that off, right? I mean, nobody wants nuclear war. They just right. want to win if nuclear war happens.
Exactly.
Right? And you know, to quote Reagan there, the only way is to win. You know, that's what some people think is that's the way to achieve the goals. But the interesting thing about this is that there's sort of a paradox about the clock or sort of a weird way of looking at it, that it's there to alert us to the danger so that we will move further away from it. So the warning on the clock is meant to catch your attention and then result in action that's meant to set the clock back further. It achieves its purpose by sort of being wrong in a weird way, right? Like if it actually...
Right.
Go ahead.
And no, I agree with you there. I think that it's been, if nothing else, it's a litmus test, right? It provides us some sort of, I'm going to use the word measurable again, very lightly. It provides us some sort of measurable, quantifiable spectrum upon which we can view the threat of humanity's doom, right? It's not fun to talk about these things, guys. You know, it's not fun to research these things because honestly, it makes me more concerned, not less, as I read these facts and these figures and exactly why they change. So obviously, the most recent in January, if you're noticing, there is a very progressive increase in the amount of times that the clock is updated, but a negative correlation of the amount of time that it's adjusted toward midnight as time continues forward.
Which could be a practical sort of part of reality as well, because you've only got, you know, you can only warn so many times. If you say you're too close, and then, you know, again, the idea being that the warning is what's supposed to drive us to take action. But there's another way to look at it, which is like, oh, they're just, here we are again at 30 seconds to midnight, but now, you know, it's, oh, no, just kidding, we're 5 minutes from midnight.
Right.
But that's actually the clock doing its job, arguably, from the perspective of its creators.
Yeah, it's supposed to ease the tension a little, right? And go, okay, we're doing things in the right direction, according to this group of scientists.
Right.
So I think 2025, the last time that it was updated, they only updated it by 1 second. I think that's notable in and of itself, because it was literally a second. There's never been a smaller amount of time that the clock's been adjusted. But I think it kind of underscores, like you were saying, the persistent and growing nature of the threats facing humanity, right? The ongoing war in Ukraine, still fighting to this day. I'll end it in 24 hours. Didn't happen. The volatile situation in the Middle East. We're seeing severe, severe overstepping of Israel into Lebanon, and not just Palestine, but Lebanon, and now the possibility of direct conflict with Iran as Iran defends Lebanon. raising, obviously, the possibility of nuclear conflict, right? Not to mention, we're still proliferating nuclear weapons. We're still intensifying the effects of climate change. If anything, drill, baby, drill, is it making the idea of climate change or the known causes for anthropomorphic climate change any better.
It's not buying us time on the doomsday clock.
Exactly. And AI is advancing vastly. And it's super cool. And you and I have been incredible proponents of how to co-work with artificial intelligence in the hope that one day AGI will take all of our jobs and we'll all just have a giant universal basic income. And like the current administration says, screw tiny little screws into iPhones along a factory line somewhere. Is this real life? Anyway, not to mention, right, that contributes directly, like directly, the AI thing contributes directly to climate change. There's a direct tie because all of those GPUs are made from silicon that's pulled from the earth. All of that silicon requires electricity. That also requires air conditioning and cooling, whether that be water or oil or air cooling. If it's air cooling, it's air conditioning. Maybe we're, you know, maybe we're getting more efficient at cooling the air within our homes, and we better want to get closer to it being more efficient because we're all going to need it soon. Anyway, the bulletin statement in January accompanied the announcement, emphasize the failure of leaders to take decisive actions to reverse all of the trends we just talked about. Ukraine war, Middle East continuing to firebomb each other, increased nuclear proliferation, intense effects of climate change, the persistent threat of bioweapons and pandemics, and the advancement of disruptive technologies all in one big, glorious, gloopy, pus-filled pocket.
So what do we do with this information now that we have it? I mean, you know, it's sort of the challenge here, right, is that this is sort of a ham-handed way to do this, but maybe it's the only way we have it. It's the best option we have. I mean, I haven't seen an alternative to the doomsday clock that really captures the sense of urgency. But what is one to do with this information, this knowledge that we're now 89 seconds from the end of the world?
Young Padawan, I'm so glad you asked. Will is older than me. Just want to point that out. I think when we look at the historical instances of when the clock has moved forward, right? We can really underscore several specific recurring themes about the nature of the threats facing humanity. In that, I feel like that is its value. If you ignore the seconds, if you ignore the updating of the clock, if you ignore the time before or after, who cares, midnight, like whatever, you can use it as a litmus test, we can use that sort of as a comprehensible collapsed model of different islands upon which we should place our concern, right? And that in and of itself has specific value.
So it's a way to track the effects of global activities, right? Like, what does it mean for the world that Ukraine has been invaded? What does it mean for the world that Israel is attacking Lebanon and Iran is now, you know, trying to step into that conflict? And what do these things mean? How does it translate into day-to-day, right? Because we're here in America, we're comfortably in our podcast dungeons here, and we're commenting on the world. But what does it mean that I'm not seeing, you know, armed troops right outside my window, but yet these things are happening across the world? Yeah, exactly. But these things are happening across.
I just want to point that out. Because it feels closer than ever before.
Right. But there's something I can still take away from this, even though I'm not directly experiencing those things. And that is meant to be communicated, I think, in the form of the doomsday clock. Is that fair to say?
100%. I mean, it's so that we can track it. Because ultimately, that it's really easy to get lost in the day-to-day of how am I going to pay my light bill, right? Like, it's really easy to get lost in the daily grind of the individual human life and lose track of a grander tracking of how global events affect our everyday lives.
And at the same time, again, going back to that sort of paradox, is that this in some ways risks us becoming sort of hardened or, you know, jaded towards this because we're seeing the moves and yet we're not feeling the difference. But that's what I would warn you against, is sort of don't take this as sort of, oh, it's happening somewhere else or it's happening on this global scale. So it has nothing to do with me, because we can take steps, right? I mean, at the risk of sounding, let's start with the sort of, this sounds pedantic. If it's 6 gallons of water every time you query a GPT or, you know, something
like that. I got to look that number up because I feel like it's wrong when I heard somebody else besides me say it.
Right. So whatever it is, right? I mean, there's a cost to our actions, right? and knowing that that cost is being realized in the real world, that for you, it's just typing on a computer, and it might be great to ask how to create a sourdough starter from GPT and get that explanation as opposed to Googling and then going to several websites that may or may not have what you want.
Yeah, or a beer recipe.
Right. Those things may be beneficial and maybe they're worth it. But at the same time, at least think before you talk to ChatGPT, right? Maybe it's about becoming a little more efficient in how you think about your questions beforehand, which is, there are side benefits to that as well. But also there's a way in which, and again, this is going to sound very Pollyanna, but that's me. And if you haven't figured out by now, I'm the Pollyanna of the group, then you probably haven't been listening very long. But
I'm the doomsday prepper.
Right. But I will say, there are things we can do, right? When you realize, hey, the whole world's sort of in this pressure cooker and the temperature is going up, maybe you can do little small things to keep the temperature from going up, if not reverse that. Maybe when somebody cuts you off in traffic, instead of laying on the horn, you can think, do I really want to contribute to the stress level of the human race right now? Or maybe can I let this one go? And I don't think that's a bad thing if we reflect a little bit more often on how our own actions contribute to the global tensions, even in small amounts. But if you put them all together, they actually may have an impact on the world.
That's absolutely true. And I do not want to distract from that. However, I am going to call an audible, and we're going to branch out to talk for a second about water and ChatGPT.
Let's talk about it. Let me grab a
sip of my
beverage.
Because I looked it up because I was like, wait a minute. Why in the hell is ChatGPT drinking water? You know what I mean? Like, I know I have to get 6 to 8 liters a day or whatever it says, but why is ChatGPT? I was right, by the way.
It's supposed to be drinking. It's supposed to be working 24/7, right? There's no time for water breaks.
Exactly. So I was right. It's cooling.
Right.
I was wrong in the quantity. So every 100-word email generated by an AI chatbot using GPT-4 requires 519 milliliters of water. So a little more than a bottle of water for a 100-word email.
So what I'm taking away from this is that the people who are using AI to spam my inbox are slowly killing the planet, or quickly killing the planet, maybe.
Yes, and if you send that exact same email once a week for a year, you've consumed 27 liters of water, which is almost 1.5 water jugs, which are 5 gallons, so 5-7 gallons-ish. 27 liters is pretty close to 7 gallons, right?
What's that, right?
Freedom units?
That's right.
Freedom units is 7.13, just over 7 gallons of water for a year for 5,200 words. All right. So if you generated one, document, a summary of what we're going to be talking about on today's podcast, you've used 300 gallons of water.
So just listen to our whole podcast. Don't summarize.
Listen to the whole podcast. Right. If not, it wasn't worth 300 gallons.
That's right.
You cheapened it. Anyway, if you sent an email of 100 words once weekly for a year in 1 out of 10 working Americans, about 16 million people, it would be equivalent to all of the water consumed by all of Rhode Island for a day and a half. I don't know why they use Rhode Island, but it's 435,235,476 liters of water. And ultimately what they say is that each ChatGPT flows through a server that runs thousands of calculations to determine the best words to use in a response. When it completes those calculations, the servers, typically housed in data centers, generate heat. Often, water systems are used to cool the equipment and keep it functioning. Water transports the heat generated in the data centers into cooling towers to help it escape the building, similar to how the human body uses to sweat, deep cool, according to Xiaolei Ren, an associate professor at UC Riverside. Where electricity is cheaper or water comparatively scarce, electricity is often used to cool these warehouses with large units resembling air conditioners. This means the amount of water and electricity an individual query requires can depend on the data center's location and vary wildly.
So there's some truth to Sam Altman's complaint that when everybody tried to studio Ghiblify themselves, or whatever you want to turn that into, when they released the new image model on GPT, there's something to that, that we're melting their GPUs. We're literally melting their GPUs.
That's absolutely right. I saw that as well this week, and I was like, why are we melting their? It depends on where their data center is. Maybe move out of Las Vegas, move to Greenland. Wait.
But we can do our part too. Maybe Studio Ghibli yourself, but maybe not your dog and your
right
seven of your closest friends. Maybe not everybody needs to be rendered in Studio Ghibli style, which apparently is the moment we're in right now.
I don't know what any of that is. All right, let's come back to our main road. Thank you for giving us that sidebar of what we were quoting and why. Where are we today?
We're 89 seconds from midnight.
89 seconds. Why do you think we're that close?
My question is, why aren't we closer?
Well, but keep in mind, now, 89 seconds is the closest we have ever been since 1947, according to this rubric.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's like you said, the problem is that there are so many different avenues now that it can take, right? We know about synthetic biology, which AI is enhancing. For everybody that's out there trying to cure some terrible illness, and God bless them for it, there's also potentially somebody out there trying to figure out how to weaponize that same virus or another virus. So we've got synthetic biology happening. We've got AI, potentially rampant AI, right? There's just a paper released by people who are in the know, and it's not a hype session. This is people saying, hey, maybe we should slow it down a little bit, because they're saying by 2027, we could have AGI, which could result very quickly in ASI, which would be artificial general intelligence, right? Where a particular model is as smart as a human. To ASI, which is where the model becomes so smart that we can't understand it anymore, and it's smarter than we are, artificial superintelligence. And if those things are, if we're a couple of years away from those things, I mean, that's very quickly potentially game over.
I do want to say, I want to accentuate that. I think we're really, really close. We just had a model this week that was able to fool the Turing test. For the first time ever, it was able to adequately fool the Turing test, which is Alan Turing put together this test that is supposedly supposed to protect us from AI taking over humanity by our not having the ability, or our having the ability to tell the difference between AI and humanity. And it was able to fool the test.
Right.
I mean, we're really, really close to AGI.
Right. In every way that matters, at least.
Yes. Yes. Not to mention, you know, all of the nuclear countries out there are in fact actually expanding their arsenals, right? From 2022 to 2023 alone, the United States has not actually increased any of our nuclear arsenal.
Not that we need to, because we've got plenty of them.
We have, so yes, absolutely. Russia currently does have a bigger stockpile than we do of nuclear weapons. So Russia's at 4,489. Our current known value of functional nuclear weapons in the United States is about 3,700. As of late 2024, it could be more now.
But let's not lose sight of the fact that it only takes 18 to knock us off
right.
our current orbit. Exactly. And so when
but
you're talking about
they all have to be detonated at the same time. Right. I do want to preface that.
Sure, but I'm just saying it doesn't really matter whether you can destroy the world 15 times or 18 times or 30 times.
Agreed.
Once you can destroy it multiple times over, the bar has been set, right? I mean,
agreed. It's really just a bunch of
quite literally overkill
countries trying to show whose biceps are bigger. Ultimately, there's only one bicep that's needed to crush a can. But if you can prove that you can crush that can crushingly, I don't know. Maybe it's a I don't know.
You can crush it.
Thing.
And compact it into a smaller.
Yeah, I was trying to I was trying to keep from talking about the cyber trucks and the truck nuts and all that. But the next largest from Russia and the United States is China. China only has 410 that they've increased by 60, so 470 nuclear weapons. China only has 470 nuclear weapons. The next one from there is Pakistan at 170, and then India at 164. Not that it matters. January 9th was when the clock was adjusted for the most recent time for global catastrophe. What does that mean? I mean, the doomsday clock was conceived with the purpose of serving as a warning to the public and the government, or governments, about the dangers threatening the existence of our species. In a lot of ways, it was created as a call to action, right? Like, asking not just leaders, or not just individuals, but leaders to recognize these specific things as threats and to take concrete steps to mitigate it. So, you know, the symbolic midnight on the clock represents a global catastrophe. We don't know what that could be, because at this point, I think I'm a millennial. So we've gone through four or five now crises that are supposed to be once in a lifetime. So it's not necessarily the prediction of a specific event, right? Like it's the potential end of civilization as we know it. And since its creation in 1947, the clock message, right, and the interpretation of the message has evolved. At first, it was, you know, nuclear war and the Cold War era, whatever. But in modern times, starting in 2007, they made a very pivotal decision to include climate change, right? Because ultimately it impacts humanity as an existential threat. They moved to increase the scope, I guess, of the clock's concerns and have even encompassed AI, disruptive technology, biotechnology, biological threats, like, you know, the pandemic that we experienced and that we could possibly be going through again. We've got mumps on the rise, measles on the rise. Polio is making a comeback. I don't know how that's even possible. But also destabilizing effects of misinformation and disinformation on elections and global security. So I guess the responsibility for setting the clock has also kind of changed, you know, since 1947. So originally it was with the editor of this scientific bulletin, Eugene Rabinovich, right? But now it's a consortium, a board of science and security consultants, along with a board of sponsors, which includes Nobel laureates and international experts on finance, on economics, on nuclear weaponry, on medicine, on health. Like, I mean, it's not just a guy, right? And I think what's important to note is, yes, it's symbolic. It was always supposed to be. But it has a very actionable impact on what we talk about with ourselves, the public, right? And it's been a symbol of peril within our popular culture, right? It's been in movies, it's in books, even music, there are video games that even, you know, that talk specifically about the clock. And some are prior to and some are after, you know, with a lot of the post-apocalyptic games being after the doomsday clock has struck midnight. But it serves as a visual metaphor, which I specifically like, because throughout my career, specifically in DevOps and in observability and site reliability engineering, we were told, like, it doesn't matter if the cluster's failing. Where can we see that the cluster's failing? Where are the giant red banners that are going, failing, failing, you know? This is that. And make no mistake, I think very much there's no magic behind this. It's not some really cool equation that you can write out, like how trade deficits work and why we can invert them and somehow charge countries a tariff that matches that. No, it's not some 4D chess problem that we can somehow pretend to solve. Exactly what it is. It provides a quick dashboard look at how close we are to killing each other,
right,
and ourselves in the process.
I think given the number of different ways that we can destroy ourselves, I think that's an important part of this net metric now, as we understand it. It's not, you know, it started with just nuclear risks. Then it became more encompassing. You know, it included climate change and disruptive technologies and so forth. I think that's part of the idea here, is understanding it's not so much how close are we to nuclear war anymore, right? That's one aspect of it, but it's also how close are we to taking a misstep of some sort that leads to total destruction, which is why I kind of jokingly told Joshua before the podcast that if I had to start over with a new visual or pick a new image to use, I kind of like the game Minesweeper, which is a favorite of one of my uncles. You know, he loves playing Minesweeper. And in Minesweeper, if you've never played it, first of all, you weren't born in the 80s probably, but if you never played Minesweeper, it's kind of this
solidly a Gen X game.
Yeah, solidly a Gen X and elder or geriatric millennials like myself.
Yeah, I didn't want to exclude Gen X. They complain about it all the time.
But, you know, the idea is that in that game, it's sort of a logic puzzle. You know, the little indicators tell you how many bombs are nearby. And the idea is you're supposed to click on all the safe spaces and leave all the bombs behind, so you try and figure out where they are. But my thought on that, the reason I like that image is because it's kind of, that's where we're at right now. It's not that we're necessarily on a time scale, which is what the clock implies. It's more just that there are so many ways that we can go. We can take a misstep here, like mishandle one global pandemic, and all of a sudden, human civilization as we know it is over. Runaway AI can quickly set humanity back thousands of years, right? Put us back in the Stone Age for all practical purposes. It's all the different ways we could step wrong, and that's where we need to be cautious when you're surrounded by so many potential landmines that can destroy us all in one misstep. You've got to start thinking a little bit more about your actions, about who you vote for, about how you, you know, talk and think and act, what causes you support, all those sorts of things. That's the upside of this. So the upshot of this for me is that we all have a lot of responsibility on our shoulders to not be the generation that moves the clock to midnight, right? In which case there is no clock, right? But that's kind of, we don't want to be the generation that ends all this. So let's take precautions. Let's take care in the way that we act and think about these things.
Yeah, I think there's two, for me, kind of as my summary, I think there's two things that particularly stuck out to me. Even if you do like the clock analogy, right? There's no 1201.
Right.
I think that's the most important one, is that there is no 1 a.m. after the clock strikes midnight, not clock strikes midnight.
This clock will self-destruct in X number of seconds, right?
Exactly. Now, I do want to kind of step back just for a second, though, and say that the last thing, right, like the last expansion of the clock's purview was, in my opinion, the most important one that we're currently facing today. And it's the erosion of trust in information.
Yes.
And it is the last included, but in a lot of ways, it's the last thing that we could rely on, right? The last thing we could rely on is what we know and what is objectively true in this increasingly subjective world. So realistically, only through concerted global efforts can humanity ever hope to turn back the hands of this clock. It's when we work together as a planet, as a species. It's not when the United States decides to do something unilaterally. It's not when Russia decides to do something unilaterally. It's not when China meets with South Korea and Japan and decides to how to respond to tariffs from one nation's actions. It's when we sit at a table and it's round, just like a clock, together, that we can look each other in the eyes and understand that all of this impacts all of us. Can we ever hope to turn it backwards? And that is today's overlap. So thank you for being with us. Thank you for listening to us ramble and rant, especially through those really difficult to listen to visualizations that I'm trying to explain to you.
And my these pop culture references.
I think you made four today that were definitively in the 80s.
First, it's a PR, but I'm looking to set the benchmark higher, so stay tuned.
Gotcha. So thank you for listening to us. Thank you for being here with us. Thank you for following us. Make sure that you do follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever that we do pop up in your life. Make sure you can visit our website at fof.foundation. You can follow us on Blue Sky at the Overlap Podcast. We post on there rather regularly. If you shout out to us, we'll make sure to shout out back, and we might even mention you up on an upcoming episode of the podcast. Will, as always, it's a pleasure, sir.
Likewise. I'll just add, if you think a friend could benefit from learning a little bit more about the Doomsday Clock, please do share the episode with a friend.
Share it with one person.
Yeah.
Annoy them about it. Make sure they listen. They have a ride to work, just like you do. Apparently, we're all going to be returning to office soon, regardless of whether it's needed. You got to have something to do on the train ride, on the plane ride, on the car ride. Anyway, we love you. Make sure to send us any emails you might have. You can get our email address there on the website, fof.foundation. And good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
And good luck.